Our headlines: Washington renews calls for talks with Pyongyang a week after the North Korean leader described the U.S. as the root cause of instability on the peninsula. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says the U.S. is seeking to ignite a civil war in his country. Plus, gunmen kill more than 40 people in an attack on a village market in northwest Nigeria. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: the United States has renewed its call for talks with North Korean officials. U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Sung Kim said Washington seeks diplomacy and has no hostile intent toward Pyongyang. The U.S. diplomat made the comments prior to a trilateral meeting with South Korean and Japanese officials in Seoul. This comes a week after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un described the U.S. as the root cause of instability on the Korean Peninsula. Kim also said that his country's weapons programs are in self-defense in the face of hostile U.S. policies and a military buildup in the South. In order to get further information about that and discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Frank Smith, our correspondent, joining us from Seoul. Frank, thank you for joining us. Frank, the United States is showing dual behavior here, imposing sanctions, holding joint military drills with South Korea, and at the same time saying that we are not harboring a hostile intent. What's going on?
Well, you know, if we listen to some of Sung Kim's remarks here, the U.S. often tries to appear as the, as taking the high ground, saying that they will meet with North Korea without any conditions, unconditionally. In fact, there are conditions on North Korea right now. There are U.S.-sponsored United Nations Security Council sanctions and unilateral U.S. sanctions that prevent North Korea from engaging in ordinary trade with the international community. And we're seeing gaps in U.S. and South Korean approach to this, with South Korea's prime minister saying that there should be consideration of relief for these U.S.-sponsored sanctions in order to bring North Korea to the negotiating table to make some progress on initiatives that are very important to South Korea that they feel would promote peace on the Korean Peninsula, in particular, an end-of-war declaration. So, again, this demonstrates kind of a duality in particular in the U.S. approach. Also, we need to be concerned about a burgeoning arms race in the region. Just this morning, there's a report of North Korea testing a missile or some type of projectile off of its east coast. As North Korean leader Kim Jong-un mentioned just less than a week ago, North Korea's missiles and its nuclear forces are developed as a deterrent against U.S. and South Korean forces here on the peninsula. We need to remember there are 28,500 U.S. troops here. The South Korean military-industrial complex is constantly developing new weapons, including, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which it has tested recently. Also, the purchase of the latest F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. So, it's not just North Korea, certainly not, the primary sort of purveyor of this arms race here, is the U.S. So, the question here in South Korea is how far can the Moon Jae-in administration, that's the president of South Korea, President Moon, how far can he go in pushing that sort of end-of-war declaration when he's up against such a sort of hard-line approach from the U.S.? Will he be able to bend it, and will we be able to see some type of negotiations that will generate a calming of tension and more peace-building here?
Frank, as you just said, South Korea's military has announced that North Korea has fired a ballistic missile toward a sea off the East Coast. I want to ask a question related to that. How much of a force do you think these missile tests are in forcing the U.S. to, you know, to appreciate that North Korea should, you know, or to push North Korea to come back to the negotiating table? And would there be any guarantees for North Korea that if they, you know, return to the negotiating table, the U.S., the talks with the U.S. will not fail, like, you know, the talks that failed under then-U.S. President Donald Trump?
Well, you answered that question at the end. The Hanoi summit was a tremendous, really, failure for everyone involved, in particular North Korea. North Korea lost faith in the U.S. as any type of negotiating partner. If we go back to the Trump administration and the number of international agreements that, Trump really broke, that 2019 Hanoi summit is really a held out as a prime example, where North Korea was willing to negotiate a reduction in its nuclear weapons programs, but the U.S., you know, took a hard line and basically walked away from those talks, and leaving North Korea really with nothing. North Korea is going to continue on the path of developing more and better nuclear deterrent unless the U.S. comes forward with something to offer to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and, again, draw down the tension on the Korean Peninsula.
Frank Smith, thank you so much for joining us and for all the information. Frank Smith is our correspondent in Seoul. Moving on, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the Lebanese Forces Party, or LF, was behind the killing of seven Shia protesters in Beirut last Thursday. Mariam Saleh has more.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Sayed Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets were fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayed Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baal Bagal Hermel. We were killed in Chaldea and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayed Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting, and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says talks on the 2015 nuclear deal should have tangible results for the Islamic Republic.
Iran has never left the negotiating table, and we are serious about result-oriented talks. The other side can show seriousness by voicing its readiness to remove the cruel sanctions.
In a televised interview, Raisi also noted that Iran has been adhering to its nuclear-related or nuclear deal-related commitments and will continue to do so. He made the comments as the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, are set to resume talks in weeks. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi warned about the presence of Daesh terrorists in the region. He underlined the necessity for the establishment of peace and stability in Afghanistan for the sake of regional security. The Iranian president also called for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan, warning that a government comprised of one political or ethnic group cannot resolve the problems of the war-stricken nation. Iran's foreign minister says his country will return to full compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal if other signatories to the accord do the same. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with UN Chief Antonio Guterres. The top Iranian diplomat also described a recent meeting between Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri and EU envoy Enrique Mora as positive. Amir Abdullahian said Iran will follow up talks with the 27-nation bloc in Brussels. This as EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said he was willing to talk with Iranian representatives if they needed some clarifications before resuming talks on the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. Iran and the remaining signatories have held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital since April to restore the troubled pact. The Ansarullah movement accuses the U.S. and Saudi Arabia of committing, quote, the most horrible crime since Riyadh began its war on Yemen.
I call on our people, the Yemen of faith, the sons of faith, to continue their efforts to face the aggression, the American-Saudi aggression, which continues for a seventh year, to commit the most horrible crimes against our people and continues to enforce sanctions and a blockade on our people.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi was addressing Yemeni people amid nationwide rallies held to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. He said Yemenis will continue their resistance against Saudi-led aggressors until the full liberation of their land from occupiers. Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in 2015 to reinstall the country's former Riyadh-friendly regime. The onslaught has led to the death of tens of thousands of Yemeni people, most of them women and children. Unidentified gunmen have killed at least 43 people in Nigeria's northwest Sokoto state. A state government spokesman said heavily armed gangs raided a weekly market in a village. He said the market was crowded with shoppers and traders when the attack took place. Earlier this month, a similar gang attack in another village market in Sabon Birni district near the border with Niger left 19 people dead. Bandits have terrorized northwest and central Nigeria for years, but attacks have become more violent in recent months, forcing thousands of locals to flee their homes. Nigerian troops have been conducting air and ground operations against bandit camps since last month. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, and his wife Zinat have sued the Nigerian secret police for withholding their passports. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zinat are asking the Nigerian court to enforce their fundamental right to movement by ordering the Nigerian Department of State Services to release their passports. The case, filed by Zakzaki's lawyers at the Federal High Court, Abuja, indicated that the secret police have placed a red flag and travel restrictions on the passports of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We made several frantic efforts to get his passport back from them, so that now the trial having been concluded and they having been discharged and acquitted, we made requisitions to the states to avail them their passports so that they can, as free citizens, travel out. But the states turned down this request.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat need their passports to travel for urgent medical treatment abroad. Zazaki's lawyer said that placing restrictions on the passports of the Islamic cleric and his wife constitutes a threat to their lives. The case has just been filed and will only come up for hearing when it has been assigned to a judge. But Zazaki's lawyers are optimistic that the hearing will commence soon.
The Fundamental Right Enforcement Procedural Rules enjoins that a matter of this nature, which is exigent, should be heard within 7 days of filing. So we're very optimistic that very soon we'll get a date in court and we'll get a case heard and decided one way or the other.
Zazaki's supporter said the action of the secret police is unconstitutional.
Denying Sheikh Zazaki his passport or restricting him to have a new one. In essence, the government is indirectly telling the world that they have stripped Sheikh Zazaki of his citizenship, which is completely wrong. He didn't commit any offense to warrant that.
Sheikh Zazaki is reported to have a dangerous and an unusual amount of lead and cadmium in his blood when he was shot by Nigerian security forces. His doctors have since advised that Zazaki be immediately hospitalized to remove the dangerous substances from his body. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Well, that's your war news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Speaking at an energy conference in Moscow on Wednesday, 13th of October, alongside the chief executives of ExxonMobil, BP and Total, the Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to deny that his country was using its control of Europe's gas supplies to advance his nation's own interests. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Matt Lane, writing for The Telegraph. The piece is titled, Could the West Do a Deal with Putin to Keep the Lights On This Winter? Speaking at an energy conference in Moscow on Wednesday, 13th of October, alongside the chief executives of ExxonMobil, BP and Total, the Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to deny that his country was using the control of Europe's gas supplies to advance his nation's own interests. We're not using any weapons, Vladimir Putin said. On the contrary, we are making sure gas supplies were stepped up. If there were any problems, there were all the faults of someone else. Russia was here to help with its neighbors. Well, up to a point, there is no question that Europe is gripped by an energy crisis as severe as any it has faced since the 1970s, and that the United Kingdom is right in the thick of it. Prices are soaring, energy firms are going bust, there is talk of factory closures, three-day weeks, and rolling blackouts. In the background, and whatever his denials, Vladimir Putin, a political leader, is well-versed in the great power politics and has levers at his disposal and won't hesitate to pull them. When he denies using gas supplies as a weapon, one thing is for certain, that is precisely what he's doing. They're as much an instrument of war as his country's tanks, mortars, and missiles ever were. And they are pointed at precisely the same place, the heart of the West. In truth, we're in the middle of a gas shock that is likely to be as profound as the oil shock that reshaped the world in the 1970s. For the government, as for the governments across the continent, the questions are about to come thick and fast. How did we get to this mess? How can we get out of it? And perhaps most of all, what price are we willing to pay to keep our lights turned on, our homes and public buildings warm, and factories open? The United Kingdom and Europe's energy crisis has been years in the making. Over the course of the past year, wholesale gas prices have risen more than fivefold. On some days of frantic trading, prices have been soaring by 20 to 30% in a single session, a sign of a market under severe stress. The reason? The switch to cleaner, renewable energy, while welcome in itself, has meant that demand for gas, viewed by policymakers as a reliable, not too dirty transitional fuel, has been steadily increasing. The massive size of stimulus programs around the world as we recover from the COVID pandemic has translated into vast and unexpected increases in demand. A lack of wind has meant that renewable energy has not been as plentiful as expected, and gas is being used as a backup. Meanwhile, China, along with much of the developing world, has been absorbing huge quantities of gas to fuel its constantly expanding industrial machine. The development of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, transported around the world on huge container ships has created a global market very similar to oil. Most of the demand comes from Asia, with Europe largely an afterthought, but the trouble with being an afterthought is you don't have much security of supply. And in the background, Russia, the only country with sufficient reserves to make a real difference to the market, is widely believed to have been holding back supplies, both to maximize its leverage with the West and to remind everyone just how much the continent still relies on plentiful supplies of its energy. The result? A supply crunch, with soaring prices and bottlenecks throughout the system. Britain has been hit especially hard. We have run down our reserves of gas to a mere 4 or 5 days of supply, far less than most of our continental rivals. Pathetic, really, for a nation as important as the United Kingdom, said Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the billionaire industrialist, tersely in a television interview this week. When we closed down storage facilities, we still had backup supplies from the North Sea. We could buy extra gas relatively easily on the world market whenever we needed it. And we had rising alternative energy sources that could be ramped up if necessary. At the same time, we ran down nuclear capacity while France was still ramping it up, and our commitment to combating climate change made it virtually impossible to reopen coal mines. The British state has been caught out as hopelessly unprepared as this crisis deepens. Granted, there is some bad luck in the process. No one could have predicted so many factors all coming together to put pressure on gas supplies at the same time, but a crisis is always, at least in part, bad luck. The point is to be prepared for the worst, not simply to hope for the best. The United Kingdom failed to do that. Everything will depend on the weather, says Laurent Rusakas, executive director of analyst firm IHS Market. When it is really cold, Russia needs a lot more gas, and that impacts on its ability to supply Europe. There are plenty of big producers of gas. The United States, Norway, and Qatar are all major exporters of natural gas, but it is Russia that holds a quarter of the world's entire proven supply, and a network of pipelines that make it the crucial player. In private, ministers and officials concede that since Russia is the world's largest exporter of natural gas, the amount it puts onto the market affects the global wholesale price. And some already believe that that is being turned into political leverage. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace told The Telegraph last week that energy was being used as a weapon by foreign states, although he was careful not to point the finger directly at the Kremlin. While the Tory frontbencher, Lord Agnew of Alton, this week went further, arguing outright that soaring energy costs were the result of a geopolitical move by Russia to put pressure on Europe. We are less vulnerable to that than some of our neighbours. And like mainland Europe, Britain does not rely on Russia for physical supplies of natural gas. The vast majority in the United Kingdom comes from British territorial waters, with the rest from reliable import partners such as Norway and Qatar and other nations in the Middle East, while less than 3% comes from Russia. Very little physical Russian gas comes to the United Kingdom because it makes no sense to transport these molecules all the way from Russia to the United Kingdom in the absence of certainty provided by medium or long-term contracts. Katya Yefimova, senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, told The Telegraph. Officials agree, we are not dependent on Russian oil or gas whatsoever. There is no concern about security of supply. This is a question of high global gas prices, a senior government source told The Telegraph. Europe gets about 41% of its gas from Russia. They are massively exposed to the threat of leverage from Moscow. The United Kingdom is fortunate enough to have sovereign access to gas reserves in the North Sea in the way that many European countries don't have. So we are far more insulated than our European partners. Officials may be breezily optimistic, but that is not the whole story. While the United Kingdom imports relatively little natural gas from Russia right now, the latter's decisions to a large extent determine the global price, and that in turn determines whether Britain can buy the supplies it needs from anywhere. Even worse, right now there is very little that anyone can do to get out of the situation. On the supply side, there is not much Europe can do, argues Simone Tagliapietra, a senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel Institute. How bad will it get? We expect the price to rise as a consequence of tight supply, says Tom Marzek-Manser of the energy consultancy firm ICIS. And that will be the main way that market copes with the issue. We have already seen some industrial shutdowns in Europe as prices rise, and we can see more of that. Once that happens, demand will start to fall. And yet, if that doesn't work, then no one really knows for sure right now what will happen. It is easy to start sketching out doomsday scenarios. We could see shutdowns, with heating and gas stoves turned off. Pensioners could die of the cold, while the rest of us put on extra coats and heat up our dinner in the microwave, assuming that electricity network is still running. In reality, it probably won't get to that point. As a first option, the government could start restricting supply to industrial users, which accounts for up to 20% of overall demand. Industries such as chemicals, paper, packaging, and building materials, all big energy users, could see factories put on three-day weeks. After that, schools and offices could also be put on three-day week to save energy. And so could retailers. A shopping mall takes a lot of heating in winter and then possibly closed completely. That would take a huge amount of pressure off the system. After that, they could be the kind of staggered blackouts we saw back in the 1970s, designed to eke out meager supplies throughout the winter. It wouldn't be great, but it would mean the heating would keep running for most families. But this would still be a catastrophe for the government. The last prime minister to put the country on a three-day week amid an energy crisis was the man who took us into the European Union, Sir Edward Heath. Historians might see a certain irony in the symmetry of the one who took us out of the European Union, Boris Johnson, repeating that humiliation. But few people would find it funny, and it would destroy any reputation of basic competence. In these circumstances, could Boris Johnson be tempted to ever strike a deal with Vladimir Putin to keep the lights on?
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here are points to ponder on the dynamics of unity and the pitfalls of discord, as elaborated by the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Stick to unity and avoid division, and turning away from each other's help and withholding the hand from one another's assistance.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the eyes of the Commander of the Faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. We said before, one of the most important things that Amir al-Mu'mineen highlighted in his speeches and his sermons and his sayings is the value of the human being himself and his value to live. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he looks at life, he looks at it from a practical perspective. He looks at it from a realistic point of view. So he wouldn't spend his time or waste his time in matters that deals with the human eternity, for example, or trying to live a longer life and things like that. Because death itself is inevitable, right? So a person lives here for a short time. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is being very realistic in this term when he looks at the human beings himself. And even when he describes death, for example, he says, إن الموت طالب حثيث لا يفوته مقيم. That death is constantly seeking people. No one will be able to escape. The residents of earth will not be able to escape death. ولا يعجزه هارب. Even those who try to flee death by, I don't know, trying to live a healthy life, trying to increase their lifespan, at the end of the day, death will catch up with them. So this is a very realistic look at life. And through that realistic look of life, then it's easy for one to put the human rights in perspective. Because sometimes when I think and I'm under the impression that I would live a very long life, to that extent, sometimes without even thinking, we think that we are immortals, we live forever. Therefore, I give myself the right to take the property of others, to harm others physically, verbally, and to infringe upon the rights of other human beings. When it comes to oppression and dhulm, it's only because I have a need and I go and take it from other people. And that's how the human rights falls apart. So the Imam is trying to say to us, first, look at life from a realistic point of view, that there is what? Death. And he says, وَإِنَّ الدُّنْيَا دَارُ فَنَا, that this life that you live in is life that will end, that will finish, that will perish. It will not stay forever. And then the Imam salamullah alayhi, he tries to bring the attention of people to the reality of this world itself. And he says, "Darun awwaluha ana." When you come to this world, you come with pain, you come with suffering. Wa akhiruha fana, and the end of it will disappear. So you're trying to, you know, work hard, and you're trying to take the rights of other people and harm other people, and then what? This is the world that you live in. Begins with pain and ends with pain. So why are you trying to spend all your life, all your time trying to seek something that won't even last for you? And then he says, "Fi halaliha hisab, wa fi haramiha iqab." When it comes to even the matters that are allowed for me and you, Allah will judge us, will question us. There will be questioning for the right halal things that we've done. What about the haram? He says, "Wa fi haramiha iqab." When it comes to things that are forbidden, Allah surely will punish us. Let us take a short break and then we continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, to the program for humanity. We said before the break that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, he's trying to bring our attention to the reality of life. And if one keeps that in his mind, then surely he will observe the rights of others. So when he looks at this world, he says, وَأُحَذِّرُكُمُ الدُّنْيَا, I advise you, I try to give you a warning of this dunya. Because why? And he says it is like a snake. لَيُّنٌ مَسُّهَا. He says the skin of a snake is soft. قَاتِلٌ سُمُّهَا. But the poison of the snake is deadly. So he says, this world that you guys live in is like that snake. It could be soft to the touch, but deadly when comes the poison. So if we don't see this world for what it is, then we're going to have a big problem. Then things will fall apart. Then you see people killing each other, people taking the right of one another, only because they fall into the trap of the snake that Amir al-Mu'minin described, which is this world. Then Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he says, you need to look at this dunya bi'ayn al-i'tibar. You need to look at it with contemplation. See what has happened to the people before you. See what has happened to the nations before you, civilizations before you. What did they take with them? Those who, for example, the pharaohs, for example, the Romans and the Persians and all these kings who took the rights of people, who demolished civilizations, who through divide and conquer and wars, they annihilated worlds. But what have they taken with them? Nothing. So if it comes to me and I look at my other fellow human beings and I want to mingle with them and deal with them, it has to be based on that contemplation that I can obviously take the rights of other people, the property of other people. But then what? Then what's the end? You look at, you know, the strongest nations in the world today. They go invade countries. They go take their wealth and their oil and what have you. And they won't last. Then they die out. They will fade out. Doesn't matter how strong they are. But they never get that lesson in life. So Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying, be more aware of this world. Because what you do, you will be questioned for it. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi also, he looks at life, most of the times he in a negative way. But there are times where he looks at life in a positive way. He says, it is daru sidqin liman saddaqaha. It is a place of truth for those who believe in what's going on, not for the people who are unaware. وَدَارُ عَافِيَةٍ لِمَنْ فَهِمَ عَنْهَا. And it's a place of safety for those who understood it. And then he says, فَهِيَ مَسْجِدُ أَحِبَّاءُ اللَّهِ. It is the place for prostration for the beloved people of Allah. وَمُصَلَّى الْمَلَائِكَةِ. And also the place where the malaika come and prostrate. وَمَهْبَطُ الْوَحِي. The place where Jibra'il, the archangel, descends to earth. وَمَتْجَرِ أَوْلِيَاءَ اللَّهِ. And it is the shopping center. It's a shop where the people, the believers of Allah, they try to gain the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, reward and so on and so forth. So that there are times where he looks at it bad when it comes to us trying to just take as much for it or from it when it comes to our worldly matters, where we just want to take the rights of other people and so on and so forth. But when it comes to looking at Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and looking at our afterlife, he says, no, it's a good thing. So you and me, the ones who go to this shop and we can buy which one we want, either our dunya or our akhirah, this world or the hereafter. The choice is up to us. Inshallah, we will continue in our class to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin. رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The Light.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who traveled to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry. Fabric cuts used to recreate Vietnamese landscapes. A woman living in the capital, Hanoi, has been doing that for 40 years now. The artist, 61 years old, explains what material she uses to create her artworks.
All the details in my artworks are cut from cloth, which is used for oyai, traditional costume, or cut from silk scarves. These are very small details, and I have to get the whole cloth for oyai. I even have to cut them from beautiful silk scarves sent from my friends abroad.
Took says sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of cloth are needed to shape the scenes. The cuts should be put together very carefully. Besides that, the woman has to work in a room without any air conditioning, even in the boiling summers of Hanoi. That's because, she says, the pieces of cloth are very tiny and would easily blown away. Her hard work has paid off. The creations sell for up to $5,000. The Vietnamese artist says her work are a summary of the passion and the beauty she has experienced after traveling across her country.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mandano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mandano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Be the first to catch the balloon. That's what competitors played to win the title at the first Balloon World Cup in Spain. The competition was held in an amusement park in the northeastern city of Tarragona. Participants had to get the balloon to touch the ground before their opponent could touch it. The event was organized by FC Barcelona player Gerard Piqué and a famous web streamer and commentator.
Get out of your comfort zone and try new things. Today we are very proud to have tried something like that, and that it has worked so well, and that people have enjoyed it. In the end, it's about people having a great time.
The competition was inspired by a trio of American siblings whose balloon game videos had attracted millions of views on TikTok and Instagram. 32 countries competed for the title. An 18-year-old teenager from Peru became the first world champion of this tournament. He defeated his German rival in a 5-minute final match. For those of you with an extreme fear of needles, this may finally be the good news. A group of Dutch researchers say they are working to create painless needle-free injections. The researchers have developed what they call a bubble gun. The device uses a laser to push tiny droplets through the skin. Take a listen to David Fernandez Rivas, the head of the project, explaining how the process is done within a millisecond.
So, within a millisecond, the glass that contains the liquid is heated by a laser. A bubble is created in the liquid, pushing the liquid at velocities on the order of 100 kilometers per hour. And we can see the gelatin, how it penetrates about 1 millimeter approximately.
Now, Rivas says the invention will help ease fear of needles and lower the threshold for vaccinations. He believes the new technology can also prevent the risk of contamination through needles and reduce medical waste. If you're eager to get a needle-free shot, you may still have to wait a few more years before they are made available to everyone. From a voyage aboard a fictional spacecraft to a real-life journey to space, a 90-year-old Canadian actor known for his portrayal of a starship captain for decades is now the oldest person ever going to space. After a couple of days of training, William Shatner hitched a ride aboard a suborbital spacecraft on Wednesday. He took off from a Texas desert as a guest alongside three other passengers, two professionals, and a paid customer. During the 10-minute flight, the team experienced more than 3 minutes of weightlessness. Now, listen to the actor describing the voyage as the most unbelievable experience of his life.
I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. It's extraordinary. I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it.
During a televised journey, the capsule took its four passengers above the maximum altitude of 100 kilometers, a point where the curvatures of the Earth can be seen. With that, the space captain of the entertainment world also broke a record as the oldest space traveler. Now, many see his experience as the embodiment of the space travel promises he made through decades of acting. The population of giant pandas in captivity has reached a record high of 673 in 2021. Official data shows this year 48 panda cubs were born, of which 46 survived. Meanwhile, the total number of overseas giant pandas has reached 69. This is the result of joint efforts by Chinese and foreign researchers following decades of caring for the lovely animals. In July, another study put the number of giant pandas living in the wild at over 1,800. The cute bears were then reclassified from endangered to vulnerable. Experts believe such research improves conservation efforts and facilitates monitoring of animal populations.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
With the help of artificial intelligence, Beethoven's 10th and last symphony is now completed. A group of German musicologists and programmers started the project over a year ago. They analyzed Beethoven's style and then used algorithms to teach a computer to complete the unfinished job. The work was released to mark the 250th anniversary of the prominent musician's birth. The team said they tried hard to solve the puzzle while remaining faithful to Beethoven's process and vision.
I believe that if a composer like Ludwig van Beethoven were to live today, he would probably not only have a large technology team around him to help him, but he would push exactly such technologies and use them for his art. And for me, art is not something that stands fixed in space and is always the same, but that changes with the world, and we can witness that today.
When the German composer died in 1827, he left behind some musical sketches for his 10th symphony. Some experts tried to complete it in the past, but they did not succeed. researchers in the United States have created an incredibly versatile robot named Leonardo or Leo. Leo was developed by a team at the California Institute of Technology's Center for Autonomous Systems and Technologies. The futuristic robot can walk a tightrope, skateboard, and even fly. Its uniqueness lies in the fact that it uses not just one, but two modes of locomotion. The researchers who developed Leo believe that similar robots will be employed on a wider scale in the future.
I think we're going to see robots like Leonardo with these extraordinary locomotion capabilities be used in things like space exploration, because they can overcome very difficult terrain, they can reach hard-to-reach places. But then I think also robots will be more and more in our daily lives. As these robots become more and more robust, more and more reliable, we're going to see them for things like package delivery or helping in the house with daily chores.
Leo is 75 centimeters tall and has four propeller thrusters mounted on its shoulders. While walking, it mimics the movements of a human by using those propellers and a pair of actuated legs. The robot can transition smoothly between flying and walking. Leonardo perceives the world around it with the help of cameras and sensors. Hot air balloons were invented in the 18th century, enabling man to finally fulfill his dream of flying. After more than 200 years, people are still eager to ride the colorful vehicles. Some even use them competitively. In the German hot air ballooning championships, balloonists will fly over the skies of the green Bavarian town of Tegernsee. 25 of Germany's best pilots are vying for first place. The organizers of the event expect a tight race, as the contestants have all managed to pass the previous competitions with flying colors to qualify for the national championship.
A zoo in northeast France has an adorable new inhabitant, a white baby rhinoceros. The cute little male rhino was born on the 6th of October. The zoo staff have given him the name of Mole. He was able to withstand less than 2 hours after being born. Mole soon started feeding from his gentle 21-year-old mother called Tala. Mole is Tala's third baby.
Children and young adults have once again come back to cinema as Iran is hosting the 34th edition of the International Film Festival for Children and Youth. Salman Kujuri has the story.
The 34th edition of the International Film Festival for Children and Youth is underway in Iran, with around 600 films from 32 countries having entered the contest. The motto of this year's festival is Cinema, the Land of Imagination. In the national section, some 440 films from Iranian movie makers have been submitted to the secretariat of the festival, including 248 short, 119 short animated, 30 feature-length and 14 feature films, 12 web series, and also 19 Korean narrations.
This edition of the festival can be considered as a festival of cinema products for the most important generation of the next century. A generation that must redefine the country in the new world and protects its power, culture, pride, and identity. Although the tragedy of the pandemic is terrible, at least it assures us that the next generation...
This is Tehran, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we're covering live the Islamic Unity the Islamic Unity Week conference. This is the 35th Islamic Unity Week conference. We're covering that live. We're breaking away from our regular programming. The first speaker is Ziad Nakhala, Palestinian leader Ziad Nakhala.